Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This fall marks the 10th anniversary of the collapse of the subprime mortgage market, a financial meltdown that threatened and profoundly damaged the world economy, with enormous consequences still with us today. My guest today has written a comprehensive book about that crisis, as well as the conditions going back decades that helped contribute to it, and how the 10-year-old crash has contributed to both political and economic insecurity here in the United States, the UK, Greece and Southern Europe, the Ukraine, and China. Adam Tooze is a historian at Columbia University and author of two previously acclaimed economic histories, The Wages of Destruction About the Economy of Nazi Germany, and The Deluge, The Great War and the Remaking of Global Order. His latest book is titled Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. It's published by Viking. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Adam Tooze, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me in.
Yeah, one reviewer referred to Crashed as a grand unified theory of the economic and political crisis of the last 10 years. I have to admit, as I was reading through Crashed, I found much to agree with that assessment. Was that your intention?
Perhaps not. I started writing the book in 2012, 2013, where we thought we had closure, but it was on a much simpler story. It was a story really about, in the end, the relatively effective crisis fighting strategy that was driven essentially from Washington and New York and had successfully prevented what I think, in the judgment of Ben Bernanke and most other people, was the risk of an absolutely apocalyptic crisis. We're talking Cuban Missile Crisis, end of the world averted. And then by 2012, the stabilization in the Eurozone as well and the re-election of Obama. So the vindication of that crisis-fighting team, not enthusiastically by the American electorate, but nevertheless, there was political and economic closure. And my aim in writing the book was really to explain to Americans and to Europeans the entanglement between the two sides in the unfolding of this crisis and its containment. And that was the original project. That's what I set out to do. So that was a relatively modest story, and it was really a story of continuity about the relationship between the United States and Europe and how America remains pivotal to global financial stability to an extent that neither the Americans or the Europeans really appreciate. And then, of course, things got a lot more complicated, and the project kind of expanded on me to take in this much wider canvas of disorder that we face today.
And those events that overtook your project were what was happening in Europe with Greece and the whole ramifications of austerity, and as well as China, a big crisis in China that I think most Americans are probably ignorant of. I mean, we knew that there were some issues with their currency, but we didn't know the extent of how it almost, I mean, it was just very narrowly averted being a major catastrophe.
Exactly. And then add to that Ukraine as well. So there's a combination of politics, both on both sides of the Atlantic. There's the ongoing financial issues in the Eurozone. And then there is the rippling effect of the financial aftershocks of the crisis on the emerging markets. And then the aggression of Russia and the expansion of Western power into Eastern Europe coming head-to-head, as they'd already done in 2008. This is the 10-year anniversary of the war in Georgia that, you know, is coming around literally as we speak today. So those factors all began to interact in a way which made the story vastly more complicated.
And can we link what happened in China in 2015 and 16 and what happened in the Ukraine to the financial crisis, the subprime mortgage real estate crash in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I flinched a little bit when I read that reviewer's comment because, you know, a grand unified theory is a sort of presumptuous thing to want to present. What I am trying to argue and to show and to guide the reader in understanding is the way in which flows of money around this global system do not necessarily dictate outcomes, but they create a pattern of shock, a kind of rhythm, an interconnectedness, a sort of tidal flow that cuts across what we think of as being separate stories. You know, when the Ukraine crisis happened, it was as though geopolitics had come roaring back, and all of a sudden we had to deal with this problem. And, you know, the Chinese near-miss crisis of 15-16 is sort of pops out of nowhere, and then, as you were saying, it sort of vanishes from consciousness as well. And what the book is trying to do is not perhaps a grand unified and complete theory, but at least to show some of the interconnecting patterns. Sometimes I like to say it's like a musical combo with the bass line turned up. And what you can hear is the drum, you can hear the rhythm section pounding along in the background, you know, moving the music forward. And that's what I think the history of finance is able to do, is to show that bass rhythm that's pushing things along. Of course, it doesn't account for the solos, it doesn't make the melody, but what it does do is drive the narrative. And in the Ukraine, money was the issue. In China in 1516, it's the deflating of an enormous credit bubble, which they start blowing up in 2008.
Now, one idea that has been around, that was certainly very prevalent prior to 2008, you still hear it talked about today, is this idea that globalization and the global economy can transcend national will and politics. I think that's one of the things your book sort of tackles, a view that this is very prevalent. You hear national leaders talking about it. You hear leaders running for Congress talking about, well, we can't do this because globalization is just a force that is ever moving forward. I think one of the ideas that you're putting forward in this book is that no national political will can change that, and it's not inevitable.
It's certainly, I mean, this is a book about finance. There are many other stories about globalization that could be written, about tech, about the oil industry, about the fossil fuel complex, about big pharma. Those all have their histories of globalization. And some of those, I think, have about them the quality of inexorability, irresistibility that thinkers like that and speakers like that invoke. I mean, how are we going to shed the carbon economy? Can we really get out from underneath that? Money and finance seems to me to be peculiar because at its heart stand state institutions. That isn't to say that all money is state-generated. Most of it is bank-generated. But at the bottom or the top of the pyramid, at the apex of the money pyramid, stands fiat money issued by states. And this is not a country-by-country story. At the top of a global pyramid stands the United States. So not only do nation states have a peculiar power over their financial and monetary systems country by country, but given globalization, the authorities of the United States have a superordinate capacity to regulate global finance and to either cut off its supply of liquidity or, in moments of crisis, amplify, increase, and thereby stabilize the system.
Now, when you look at the crises of the last 10 years, certainly, you have to go back further than 10 years, but when I was thinking about when you might start, say, in the early 2000s as we're coming out of the dot-com bust, or you could, say, go back to the 90s when banks were increasingly deregulated. But you actually go back to 1971.
Yes, yeah.
When Nixon exited the gold standard, he said, really, to understand the last 10 years, you have to go back 50 years, practically.
Yes, because it's an underrated moment in human history, the Nixon moment. You know, it may be a low point in human history, too, but it's an underrated moment because it's the moment at which the United States government detaches the dollar from gold. And in so doing, it removes all of the global currency from a metallic base. And this is the first time in the history of money, ever in the history of money, and this is a foundational, fundamental institution of societies, not modern ones, but all human complicated societies going back to the ancients, that money is no longer attached to a metallic foundation. We no longer anchor the means of exchange to some physical base. From that moment onwards, the political nature of money, whatever else happens with it, whatever business banks do with it, ultimately, it has an irreducibly political foundation. And it's a kind of hybrid thing. It's both simultaneously irreducibly capitalist and irreducibly emerged in the world of business and of commerce and that expansive realm, and irreducibly founded fundamentally on the authority of states. And that is a profoundly unstable situation at first, which sets up the inflationary surge of the 1970s, and then we start getting into that story of crises that you began with just a second ago.
Now, one of the first stories you tell in Crashed is a meeting between former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin and Peter Orszag, who was also in the Treasury Department, the architects in some ways of the moment when the United States emerged from a annual budget deficit in the late 1990s. They're meeting in 2004, and they're worried about the return of the federal deficit. Here it is. This is the pre-stage of what would become the subprime meltdown and the mortgage crisis in the United States. And here they are. They're worried about the federal deficit. This is a very interesting point because here it is. They're literally, 12 to 18 months from the first evident signs that things are going awry, and yet they're worried about the budget deficit. And here we are today with, I think this year it's going to be $800 billion. Next year it's scheduled to be $1 trillion. Do budgets really matter anymore?
Well, this goes back to the story we were just telling a second ago, because once you exit a world in which money is tied to gold, everyone begins to get very anxious about what it is tied to. And there is a terrible fear, if you like, that money will in a sense just be printed. And the way in which money ends up being printed by governments is they basically sell debt to the Federal Reserve. It then issues money in exchange. There is a profound anxiety about a kind of doom loop that might be created, a Venezuelan-style hyperinflationary disaster, which would result from a lack of fiscal rectitude. And the Democratic administration, this is another kind of temporality, another timeline that matters. The Clinton's Democratic administration of the 90s had a chip on its shoulder. It had to prove that it was fiscally prudent. And Robert Rubin and his cohorts are really the architects of a new alliance between a culturally, liberally progressive Democratic elite on the one hand and Wall Street on the other. And their preoccupation, perhaps not surprisingly, is government debt and containing it. And they're very critical of the Bush administration's fighting the war on terror and granting tax cuts and running up the deficit and running up the debt. And what their blind side is, the blind side of these business-orientated Democrats is business. The blind side of these people is, as you're saying, even a couple of years out from the financial crisis, they don't see the bubble which is actually going to blow up, which is the bubble in the of financial capitalism. The problem is not government in the end. It's not government debt. It's privately generated debt. It's privately generated finance that's going to blow up. And ironically, at that moment, when private finance does blow up, what is it that people want to put their money in? What is the piggy bank that is safest? Ironically, it's treasuries. It's government borrowing. So far from being the weak link in the crisis, it turns out that treasuries are the place of safety. They are the safe asset of last resort, is lending money to the American government. Believe it or not, that's actually the safest thing you can do.
One question I had from reading that first section of the book was, we have to remember that the dot-com bust happened in late 1999 and 2000, and a lot of effort was put in expanding the real estate market, expanding the pool of borrowers, people who would buy housing. And was that a conscious effort by the Federal Reserve and by policymakers that sort of helped create this bubble?
I think there's no doubt that the bust in dot-com is another one of the key triggers, because that inflicts in the first round losses on American investors as large as eventually the housing bust will inflict in 2007, 2008. And in response to that shock, the dot-com bubble bursting, Greenspan very aggressively reduces interest rates. And one of the things that will set in motion, and he's, as any other Fed policymaker would be, is a huge wave of mortgage lending. Crucially, in fact, it's refinancing. As interest rates go down, Americans are able to refinance. They churn their mortgages. And this generates a vast amount of business for the American mortgage industry. And it's that industry geared up to do the refinancing triggered by the Greenspan interest rate cut that then morphs into the subprime machine, which is really quite a short period. It's really between 2004 and 2007 that this big chunk of subprime finance is added on top, which turns out to be the straw, if you like, or that's too harmless a metaphor. That's really the element of risk that brings the system down.
My guest today is Adam Tuzzi. He's a professor of history at Columbia University and director of the European Institute, and his new book is titled Crashed: How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. It's published by Viking. One of the things, as you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, you said one of the things you wanted to write about was relatively the successful way American institutions responded to the financial crisis, the mortgage crisis, the huge amount of money of liquidity the Federal Reserve put into all sorts of institutions, from the big Wall Street banks to the Eurozone and the European Central Banks. And that story, he said, really, in many ways, that averted a far worse financial crash worldwide. Many people are reluctant to compare what happened in 2008 to the Great Depression. But in many ways, this was worse than the Great Depression, the initial loss of of money.
Yes. No, the crucial difference about 2008 relative to 1929 is the scale, the speed, the coordination, the synchronization of financial crises across the banks of the entire world. Every single major banking sector would basically have suffered a heart attack simultaneously, more or less simultaneously, between September and October 2008, had it not been for massive central bank action. And there is nothing to compare to that in the story of 1929 to 33. Also, we know that the real economic effects of that shock to the financial system in 2008 were savage. So industrial production, international trade is falling more rapidly on a larger scale in the winter of 2008 than it was in 1929. So if it had been allowed to continue, if the loss of jobs running at the rate of 800,000 jobs a month in the United States over the winter of 2008-9, 800,000 jobs a month, if the implosion of world trade had been allowed to continue, there's every reason to think that it would have been even worse as a disaster than the crisis of 1929 to 1933. What, of course, we know now with hindsight is that, in fact, it was effectively stabilized. But we really, I think, have to pull back into consciousness quite how spectacular the risks were.
And what were those risks?
Well, the risk was that the economic system would not just suffer the flu, it would just suffer a full-on fatal heart attack. So there would have been the complete cessation, essentially, of economic activity across large parts of the economic system. It would have been more like a power outage, if you like, just a complete shutdown. AAA-rated entities like Harvard University having difficulty getting short-term credit to make payroll. GE couldn't get short-term credit. Mainstays, pillars of the American economy, were being deprived of financial oxygen at this moment. And you don't come back from that. You know, once a system has been stalled out in that way, it's very difficult to rebuild. So the sense of apocalyptic existential risk, which you see across all of the policymakers at that moment, as they look at the screens, as they look at the accounts of the businesses that they're able to access, we have to take that, I think, absolutely seriously.
Now, the next story becomes then, how do you replace all that money that disappeared, say, within a month span, as all these mortgage-backed instruments were revealed as worthless, that people had invested money in and thought add value? And, of course, in the United States, there was a stimulus. There was a lot of debate over whether the stimulus was large enough or too large. And I think in hindsight, most people said that it was adequate, but it didn't ease enough of the suffering to get credit for the political leaders that put this idea forward. In Europe, a completely different attitude, which also causes the next crisis. And this is this huge wave of austerity. Their response was not to stimulate their national economies. It was to contract. What did this lead to?
Well, we see a absolutely divergent path from 2009-10 onwards. The story of 08 is one of synchronization between Europe and the United States. From 2010 onwards, the United States economy slowly claws its way back from the disaster of 08-09. Very disappointing growth, but nevertheless growth. What we see in Europe is a double-dip recession. The Eurozone economy slumps from 2011 and stays deeply depressed until 2013 at least, and the worst affected economies like Greece are still vastly below their 20 to 25% below their pre-crisis level, showing only modest signs of growth, with investment massively depressed, almost 60% down on its pre-crisis levels. So the Eurozone economy is hit hard, looks as though it's recovering in 2009 like the US, and then is hit hard again by this self-inflicted financial crisis in the Eurozone triggered by the Greek debt problems.
Now, this whole idea of choosing austerity, was that a political calculus, or was it a philosophical viewpoint, or was it what they thought the best course was given the reality of their debt?
Well, I think one has to take it seriously as an economic vision. I like the way that you formulated that question. I think one really does have to acknowledge that, you know, the Germans in particular are pursuing a very long-term vision. I mean, their idea is that stabilizing European finance is appropriate because European society is aging. It faces fierce international competition, and so you want to keep tax rates low is part of their argument. They neglect and forget, of course, that without government spending, it's quite hard to have high rates of investment. But this is the kind of rationale that is offered, and they are extremely concerned about problems of misbehavior, if you like, within the federal structure of the Eurozone, within the federal structure of Europe, of people taking advantage of free riding by countries. And so what they feel they need to build political confidence and political trust in the institutions of the EU is a core set of discipline. And once that's in place, one can talk about the longer run prospects for growth. The problem, in a sense, is time horizons. That is not an irrational position to adopt over a 10 to 20-year time horizon. But the problem is that Europe is suffering a recession right there, right then, with the spiraling financial crisis, financial market crisis of 2011, 2012.
And this becomes the other part of the story, the fact that this is not just an economic story, this is also a political story, and political leaders have to run for re-election. And what's happened is, in the wake for both Western Europe and for the United States, you've seen similar reactions in many ways of how electorates respond to this crisis.
Yeah, you absolutely do. And to talk, I think, in general terms about populism as a phenomenon of this period is quite misleading, because if you look at Spain or Greece or Portugal, you see essentially a huge left surge. It's as though the Sanders wing of American politics had swept the board, a very left-wing government, both in Portugal and in Greece. And then at the other end of the European continent, a reaction which is straightforwardly nationalist, xenophobic, and this is, of course, compounded by the refugee crisis of 2015-2016. So we really see polarization in response to a common shock. If there is this sweeping force of the financial crisis and its aftermath running across the political systems of the West, how they then respond is very, very dependent on national histories, the force field of local politics, sheer coincidence and accident in some cases, and then a complex set of interrelationships between them, which mean that, you know, left-wing politics in Portugal takes encouragement from left-wing politics in Greece, for instance.
My guest today is Adam Tooze. He's a professor of history at Columbia University. He's director of their European Institute and the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. It's published by Viking. It's a big book that really looks in depth at the last 10 years, but really goes back much further to look at the origins of where we are today. And today we're here, gosh, it seems very, you know, we're looking at a Congress that is looking to roll back what some observers would say the little safeguards that were put in place after 2008. You also have looking at a trade war and tariffs going up. Is this all go back to how electorates and politicians have reacted to the last 10 years?
Well, my sense is that we are indeed looking at a fairly long-running crisis in the GOP, in the American Republican Party. There's no point, I think, in mincing words about this. It's not bipartisan. It's a question, really, of one of the two great governing parties of the United States suffering a fairly profound crisis of its identity. And that really came to the fore in 2008. Some people would trace it back to Iraq or possibly even to the Newt Gingrich period. But in 2008, you have this extraordinary spectacle of a Republican administration in the middle of an election year, struggling to get and failing to get the backing of the majority of the members of its own party in Congress for actions which are, by common consent, I think, necessary for the survival of the American economy. I mean, the nationalization of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is simply essential to the functioning of the American mortgage system. It doesn't function without them. And Paulson and the Bush presidency Paulson, as Treasury Secretary at the time, cannot muster the votes from his own side of the aisle. He ends up relying essentially on the Democratic majority in Congress. And the same is true for TARP. And the stimulus is passed against the solid opposition of the Republican Party at a time when 800,000 people are losing their votes every single day. So at that moment, something quite fundamental is happening, I think, in American party politics. And in the extraordinary combination of trade war and tax cutting, budgetary expansion at the height of a fiscal cycle that we're seeing in the height of a business cycle. So the leaning in, with the wind, expanding the government deficit at a moment when the American economy is running as fast as it's run in years. This kind of incomprehensible economic policy from a conventional point of view is prefigured, I think, in some of the actions that we're seeing on the GOP side of the House back in 08.
Now, you mentioned Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. One of the things your book does is really look at this idea that conservatives have put forward that it was all government-backed securities that caused the crisis. And what did you find?
That isn't a story which holds up. It's an argument that's run and run and run ever since the events of 07-08. Indeed, it goes back earlier. I mean, the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are deeply political institutions. There's no getting away from that. They're products of the Great Depression, of the New Deal, and of then the reshaping of those institutions in the late 1960s. They are political powerhouses in Washington, D.C. They have friends and they have enemies. And so it's not surprising that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac get accused of essentially having, engineered an excessive, irresponsible expansion of subprime lending before the crisis, which is at the root of the problem. If only the markets had been allowed to set the price properly for high-risk debt, the argument goes this would never have happened. And it's just not sustained by the evidence. The far more adventurous lending was being done by private lenders. The big subprime push is driven by, in fact, the withdrawal of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac from lending in the final stages of the upswing. They end up buying some of those assets in part simply to keep up with their private rivals. So the story just doesn't hold water, but you can see its political significance. It's emblematic of the fact that housing finance is a political hot potato. And so in a partisan system like the American one, you're going to get that kind of argument surfacing and resurfacing again and again.
Again, going back to the origins of this book, you were starting out to write a fairly optimistic story.
I was, yeah.
What's your feeling about the world economy today? Are you still optimistic or fairly pessimistic about the near future?
I think if the issue is the capacity and willingness of the United States to manage the next big global financial crisis, one has to be pessimistic. Compared to the kind of globalist vision of the economy which both the Republican and Democratic Party elite espoused in 2007-08, in the well-understood, enlightened self-interest, of course, of the United States, not because they're not globalists for the sake of it, I think we're in a different moment now. That makes me pessimistic. What makes me optimistic is I don't see an immediate repetition of the 08 scenario on the horizon. And then what makes me pessimistic again is when I ask myself where there could potentially be another crisis. It's in Asia, which is precisely the place where, new antagonisms are being fostered between the United States and China by means of the trade war, and much more broadly in a geopolitical sense if you look at the national security strategy of the U.S. And yet it's precisely there that the financial integration is really, this is the new frontier of financial integration, and it continues to be dollar-based. So the United States remains the indispensable apex of the global monetary system, and that monetary system now emphatically includes as its key kind of expanding frontier East Asia, and yet that's also a zone of rising great power antagonism, and that is not a configuration that should make one feel optimistic, I think.
Adam Tooze is a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.